May call your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. And before we call this witness, I just want to let you know our next plaintiff witness is also an artist, and she's brought a couple pieces she'd like to discuss in the course of her testimony that we've arranged with Ms. Looney to have displayed, if that's okay. Thank you. Plaintiff's call, Olivia Vesevich. Can you please state your name?
My name is Olivia Vesevich.
Could you please spell your name?
Olivia Vesevich.
And how old are you, Olivia?
I turned 20 last month.
And how old were you when this lawsuit was filed?
I was 16.
And where do you live?
I live in Missoula, Montana.
Were you born and raised in Missoula?
Yes, I was.
And what family members do you live with, Olivia?
I live with my mother, my sister, and our two dogs.
Do you have other family in Missoula?
Yes, I have my grandparents and my cousin.
That's pretty great to have grandparents close by. Do you spend much time with them?
Yes, I try to spend as much time with them as I possibly can. I try to help take care of them, and I love them with all my heart.
Have you ever testified in court before today, Olivia?
No, I have not.
Are you attending college currently?
Yes, I attend the University of Montana at the Davidson Honors College.
And what is the Davidson Honors College?
The Davidson Honors College is an honors program that the University of Montana offers, and it provides a community-based mindset and accelerated courses that are in various fields of study that extend outside of my main field of study.
Were you awarded a scholarship to attend?
Yes, I was awarded the Provost Scholarship and another and an array of scholarships from the University of Montana.
Is the Provost Scholarship a big honor?
Yes, it's a very high honor.
Did that scholarship cover your full tuition?
Along with the other array of scholarships, yes, my tuition is fully covered.
Oh, that's great. What are you studying in college?
I am majoring in English with two minors, or with a concentration in teaching, and two minors, one in art and one in women and gender sexuality studies.
And are you an artist, Olivia?
Yes, I am.
Please tell us about your art.
My art is an exploration of my own personal experiences, along with the natural world and the mystical elements that exist within our world.
At this time, Your Honor, I would like to direct the court's attention to the wire sculpture there to Olivia's right. And Olivia, could you please describe this?
Yes, so this is a sculpture that I began making in 2020. It is titled Humanity's Disconnection from the Waters, and it is an exploration that I did about humanity's disconnection from our natural world and the ways in which this disconnection has allowed for climate change to pollute and put our environment in danger. And there are many elements to it, if I may explain each element. So the mermaid sculpture structure is initially supposed to be a representative of the disconnect from the human half. This is only of the fish half. There is no part of the human half, and this is to represent our disconnection from the natural world. And then the plastic bag, the wire sculpture is filled with plastic bags that I saved from being thrown away to discuss the impacts of plastic pollution in all of our waterways and in our natural world. And then the mermaids are often known to be colorful. And I added the wire, or the yarn, the acrylic yarn to this piece to represent three things. One, is the tangled web that is climate change and how there are so many complexities to it and the intricacies of the climate crisis. And then it also represents acrylic yarn is made from synthetic fabric. And each time we wash our clothes with this synthetic fabric, it adds microplastics to our waters. And this is a commentary on that. And it is also a commentary upon the fishing wires that are among some of the highest polluters of our seas. And that explains it to a great extent, although it is not the full extent, but yes.
Thank you, Olivia. And do you have another art piece in the courtroom today?
Yes, I do. I have a painting titled Gaia.
And Your Honor, should we allow the wire sculpture to...
Thank you.
Away? Thank you. Well, Your Honor, may I approach the witness with her other piece of art?
Yes. Thank you. So this is a painting that I made in 2021, and it is titled Gaia, which is another name for Mother Nature. And Mother Nature is within all of us. And so this is also a self-portrait of myself. And it is about the climate despair that I feel, about the despair that I feel about climate change. I made this when I was in the brink of my sadness and I just needed an outlet. And so I turned to art, as I often do. And this was an exploration of my despair. So the waterfall tears represent precisely what I was feeling in the moment when I made this painting. And then the orange and yellow glow around Gaia is representative of the fact that our world, my world, is on fire. And this painting might look only full of despair, but I choose to have hope. I choose a world in which there is no hope is a far too devastating reality. And I know that our world, I know that our people are resilient. I know that I am resilient. And I know that we have, albeit fleeting, time. There is still time. And the flowers are representative of that. They're representative of the hope, of the resilience of us, of nature, of everyone. And this is a painting that I made in my, like, one of my saddest moments about climate change. But I made it because I know that even in those moments of, like, despair, the definition of despair is complete and utter lack of hope. But I found that hope because I know it exists. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivia. And what does the moon symbolize in this painting?
The moon symbolizes my family, primarily my grandmother. One of her nicknames is the Moon-Faced Girl. And so I added her in this painting because she is the person that helped develop my moral compass. And I love my family. I have the deepest love for them. And it also represents my love of this world and my love of the waters because the moon controls the tides of the oceans. Thank you.
You must be really close to your grandmother.
Yes, I am. There's so many aspects of my grandmother, but one that is coming to me now, what I would like to share with everyone, is that purple is the color of my heart, is the color of highest love in my family. My grandmother, she was a child, an elementary school librarian at Hugget Elementary in Missoula, and her last name is Pearl, and P-U-R-L, and one of the kids called her Miss Purple. And so then she began wearing purple all the time, and it just became her color, and she passed it down to me. And my other grandmother in Croatia actually has a purple house, and so purple is just the color of my family. It's my sister's favorite color, and that's why my hair is purple, is because it's the color of my family, and like I said, the color of highest love to me.
Thank you, Olivia.
Thank you.
Olivia, you mentioned you're pursuing a major in English with an emphasis in teaching. Why did you choose that major?
I chose that major because I, throughout my entire life, have always known that I've wanted to be a teacher. And I believe in the power of future generations, and I want to be one of the people that is helping provide them a safe space to learn and grow in and become the full extent of what they can be, because I think that is why, that's part of our beauty of humanity, is that each person has an opportunity to become the greatest version of themselves. And my teachers have helped me become the greatest version of myself, and I want to help future generations have the best future they can possibly have.
Olivia, I've placed a slide on the screen. Do you recognize this image?
Yes, I do. This is an image of me teaching. I actually work at this Montessori now, but this was before. I worked there. My mother works there, and I was teaching some students French as part of my international baccalaureate program. I had a creativity action service project, and this was in a series of three times that I went with the students to teach them a little bit of the French language, French culture. We did some drawings of like the biggest French cultures, like aspects of like the Eiffel Tower and stuff. And it was a really fun experience. It was one of my first experiences with teaching, but definitely not one of my last.
What do you like to do for fun, Olivia?
I like to do a whole array of things. As I've testified, I am an artist, so I love to work in art. I love to make art with my friends, go outside and like watercolor in parks. I love to go on hikes with my dogs, as seen in this photo from Mount Jumbo on the L Trail that I took this year on one of my hikes with them. I love to go on hikes with my friends. I specifically love flower hikes. Those are some of my favorites. I love to go swimming with my friends. This is an image that was taken last summer when I went with my best friend and her little brother up to Salmon Lake, and we had the whole lake to ourselves. We went on the weekday, and it was just a really fun and special experience to get to swim in Montana's lovely, beautiful waters.
And living in Missoula, you must spend a little time on the Clark Fork River. Is that true?
Yes, I love to float it as much as I can. This is an image that I took in October of 2022, and because I love the autumn and I just thought it was so beautiful, just walking on the bike trail, and I was just in awe of the beauty of Missoula.
What's your favorite place to go to in Montana?
My most favorite place in the entire world is Flathead Lake, specifically Skidoo Bay. It's where my family and friends had a lake cabin, and I spent my summers there as a child. Just every single summer, we would go up as much as we possibly could, like two times, like every weekend. And this is just a place where I swam, the place I learned to swim. It was the place where I fell in love with Montana, and it was the place where I fell in love with the great outdoors.
Olivia, do you recall when you first learned about climate change?
Yes. I feel like I had always had a knowledge that I can't remember like exactly when I knew. I just feel like I grew up knowing that climate change was pertinent to us, but I had no idea to the extent that it would be. But I remember I was in my sixth grade class, and we were in the sixth grade science class, and we were talking about Glacier National Park. And my teacher told us that our generation's children would be the last generation to see the glaciers in Glacier National Park. And that just sent me reeling. It's spiraling. I had no idea that climate change was going to steal the glaciers from one of Montana's most beautiful places. And it sent me into a long journey of studying climate change and becoming a climate activist. It sparked that in me.
Have you studied climate change in any of your classes in college?
Yes, I recently took an environmental science course in my first semester of college.
You mentioned that you got into activism, and could you please describe what we're seeing here?
Yes, in this photo, we're seeing a picture of me and some other people outside of John Tester's office in Missoula. This was a walkout that it was partly a walkout that some of my fellow club members did. The girls in the front, we were all in high school at the time, and we were all part of a club called SAVE, which is Students Against Violating the Environment at Hellgate High School in Missoula. And then we met with Sunrise Movement, and we were protesting for the Green New Deal.
And did you ever begin organizing yourself?
Yes. Later that year, I began organizing myself. I enjoyed protesting, but I felt like I wanted my voice to be heard, and I wanted to be involved in the organizing aspect of climate activism. And so I had an opportunity to work with a wonderfully talented group of people to organize Missoula Climate Strike in September of 2019. And it was my first time speaking at a rally. I spoke to a crowd of, I think, over 200 people. And it was very powerful. I got to listen to so many wonderful speakers that day, and working with so many wonderful activists in Missoula, it just made me feel hopeful for a future, to know that there were so many wonderful people working on this.
Is it important to you to bring awareness about climate change to others?
Yes, it is the most pertinent issue of our times. And I think that everybody needs to know exactly how critical climate action is.
Olivia, I've put another image on the screen. Can you please describe this?
Yes, this is an image of me biking along the Madison Street pedestrian bridge earlier this year. And Missoula has a wonderful trail system, a bike trail system, and you can bike to so many places in Missoula without ever having to cross the street, and it makes Missoula really, Missoula is a very bike-friendly town, and I try to bike as much as I possibly can, especially when we're in nicer months. I don't bike in winter, but I do bike as much as I can.
Why do you choose to bike?
To lower my own personal carbon footprint. I think that I think every step is very important. And so I do my best to minimize my own carbon footprint.
Do you take other steps in your personal life to minimize your carbon footprint?
Yes. My family and I have a farm share. So we get our vegetables from a local Missoula grower. So we minimize our carbon footprint in that aspect, and also food to eat. Locally organic food is always wonderful. I try to minimize my electricity use and just like all of the basic things like water, limiting water use, eating the fewest amount of meat as the littlest amount of meat that I possibly can. And, yeah.
Do you think it's important that everyone does their part to limit their impacts on climate change?
Yes, I think that everybody has a role to play in this. I think that my role is important, and I also know that the state of Montana's role in limiting their carbon footprint is vastly important.
Olivia, has climate change impacted you personally?
Yes, climate change has definitely impacted me personally.
And can you give us some examples or an example of your lived experience that you could share with the court in this space?
Yes. Climate change has impacted my ability to breathe. I have the smoke. It makes it very challenging for me to breathe. This is an image that I took this May, which was a very harrowing time to see smoke starting so early in the Missoula Valley. It made me feel very terrified for what this summer holds, and I am still terrified for how smoky our summer will be.
Do you have asthma, Olivia?
Yes. When I was in seventh grade, I was diagnosed with exercise-induced asthma, and I was prescribed an inhaler.
How does wildfire smoke affect your asthma?
Wildfire smoke, it makes it so my asthma is triggered even without exercising. I could simply be outside, and I would need to use my inhaler because of the way that smoke is. And to describe the way that smoke makes me feel, it feels like it's suffocating me if I'm outside for too long. Like if I'm outside for minutes, that's the max amount of time I can be outside on a bad day. I feel like I can't breathe. I feel, and that's a terrifying feeling to not be able to breathe and that, yeah.
Have you had an experience, kind of a firsthand experience dealing with a wildfire itself?
Yes, I have. One of my first experiences with knowing exactly how scary forest fires were, I was at a horse camp when I was a child, and there was a fire on the Lobo Mountain right next to Highway 12, and it closed Highway 12. And my mother, she called, like, I remember calling on the landline, and I was calling my mom, and I was just telling her that camp was, like, gonna be shut down. Like, most kids went home because most of them lived in Lolo, and so they weren't, they didn't have to stay. But the highway to get to where I was closed, and so my mom couldn't come get me. And I remember hearing the panic in her voice, the sheer panic. She was so scared. And that terrified me, like, to have your mother be terrified. And I remember comforting my little sister. And it was my mother. Like, she wanted to drive around the other side, which would have been, like, a five-hour drive. Luckily, the smoke cleared out, or the fire cleared up enough for her to come through. But I remember there was a moment there where I thought the fire was going to come and, like, get to the ranch where I was, and that I was going to have to go even further away from my mother. And it was just a very scary experience to experience as a child.
Do you remember about how old you were when that happened, Olivia?
I don't exactly. I would say probably like 9 or 10.
How did you and your family cope with wildfire smoke in the summer?
We close all of the windows in our house. We have air purifiers, but in times when it's really bad, my mother will look at a smoke map. And she will find where the smoke is, where the air quality is best and the smoke isn't. And we will go on a trip there. We've gone on trips to other parts of Montana, Washington, and Idaho.
Olivia, I placed another image on the monitor. Could you please describe what we're seeing here?
Yes. So I have spring allergies. And as the years have gone by, they have gotten increasingly worse with my eyes swelling shut. This was taken at a time when my allergies weren't even as bad as they get. And as you can see, it's a very painful experience to have your eyes be swelling shut and so red and itchy. And I can barely see, and it completely takes like my whole like week that it lasts, or 2 weeks that it lasts, just completely controls that.
So does it impact the activities you usually do?
Yes, I really don't go outside. I don't go see people because, they're swelling shut, and I look a little silly. So it's, I don't really go and see people, which is, that's a lonely time, but it definitely impacts my activities.
Olivia, when you showed us your art, particularly your Gaia painting earlier, you mentioned your climate despair and how it's reflected in your art. Do you believe climate change is impacting your mental health?
Yes, I absolutely believe that climate change is impacting my mental health. As I've testified earlier, it impacts my way to breathe, my manner of breathing, and like I said, like not being able to breathe, that is a very scary panic inducing experience, which, and then not like my eyes being in so much physical pain also has a psychological toll on me. But also, I would say the biggest thing that has impacted my mental health is the not knowing what our future holds and knowing that there are so many actions that the people in power, the state of Montana, can take to minimize these reactions, to minimize the effects of climate change, that there are so many things, and knowing that people just aren't listening to what people have been begging for decades.
How has your anxiety, Olivia, over the climate crisis impacted your plans for the future?
As I previously testified earlier, I said that I've always known that I wanted to be a teacher. I've also always known that I wanted to be a mother. But I don't know if that's the future that there will be for me. Climate change is reaping so much havoc in our world right now. And I know that it will only be getting worse because as I've seen throughout my life, the effects of climate change have gotten worse. They have, the severity of my experiences has increased year by year. And I know that it will continue to do so if we continue with business as usual. And I know that I would not want to make a child endure that. And it has been one of the greatest sadnesses of my life, knowing like my family is one of the most important parts of my life and knowing that I might not get to start a family of my own. It breaks my heart. It really does. And yeah.
Olivia, can you help us understand what your anxiety feels like in your body?
Yes. So it feels, experience my anxiety in a lot of ways, in a lot of places in my body, but I would say like the biggest one would be, it feels like there's this giant weight on my chest that's crushing me. And I would say it probably feels most like, I describe it as like an elephant sitting on my chest. It feels like this crushing thing that's just weighing on me, and it makes it hard for me to be able to breathe, and it makes, I also feel it in my throat, and I feel, like, it feels like something's grabbing my throat, like, from the inside, and then you feel it in my eyes, and the tears that start. And also in my nose stings every time I cry. But I definitely feel my pain of climate change throughout my body.
Olivia, you testified earlier about all of the actions you're taking personally to reduce your impact on climate change. Do you believe the state of Montana also has an obligation to do its part?
Yes, I know that the state of Montana has an obligation to uphold our constitutional rights. They have an obligation to uphold our constitutional right to a clean and healthful environment. And I know that the state has the power to do so. I know.
Olivia, why did you decide to become a plaintiff in this lawsuit and sue the state of Montana?
I wanted my voice to be heard. I wanted the court to hear my voice and hear my story. I wanted to make a difference in this world. I love our world so much. I have the deepest love for everyone in this world and everything that is a living being and even all of the rocks and everything, every part of our beautiful world. And I wanted to speak up for our world and I wanted to speak up for myself. And I wanted to speak up for those who do not have a voice. And I had the opportunity to be a part of this case. And I wanted to amplify the voices of those who are not heard and those who are not yet able to be heard.
Olivia, what are you asking the court to do to help you?
I am asking the court to uphold our constitutional right to a clean and healthful environment. And I'm also asking the court to listen to the experts that have spoken in this testimony and have spoken in this trial. And I'm also asking you to listen to all of the other plaintiffs and everyone that has been asking for so long. I just want you to listen to us and really hear us.
Olivia, when you described your Gaia painting, you talked about that it also symbolizes hope. As you sit here today, do you still feel hope?
I do. I have felt so much hope throughout the course of this trial, getting to listen to all of the people that care, getting to see all of the support for this case, and getting to hear from all of the experts I have so much hope for that our state is going to take our actions, and I have hope that other states are going to take our lead, and that the rest of the world is going to follow our lead, and that we still do have time. And I know we have time, and I know that everyone in this world is resilient, and I know that we all can and will. I have hope because an alternative is not a world that I want to live in. I do not want to live in a world without hope, so I will always carry the hope within my heart, and I know that so many people also carry that hope with them.
Thank you, Olivia. I have no further questions.
Thank you.
No questions.
All right. Thank you. You may step down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
At this point, I'd like to call our next expert, Dr. Lisa Van Susteren. Can you spell that for the record?
Yes, L-I-S-E, Van, V-A-N, space, capital S-U-S-T-E-R-E-N.
Where do you live, Dr. Van Susteren?
Washington, D.C.
What's your role as an expert in this case?
I'm here to evaluate the facts and the science as it pertains to my testimony. I'm also here to give my opinion about the emotional toll that climate disruption has on the plaintiffs, future generations, and young people generally, and to address specifically the emotional toll of the MEPA climate exception on the plaintiffs and future generations and young people. I also will offer an opinion about what the court could do to alleviate some of the harms coming to the children and what the court could potentially order for the state to assure that these children are protected.
All right, let's see, learn a little bit about your background, learn why you're qualified to testify on these topics. Your exhibit has been marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit 195, and I'd like to move that into evidence. It's my understanding defendants don't object, but...
No objection.
P195 is submitted. Is that for CB?
That's for CB, I'm sorry. Dr. Van Susteren, can you please describe your educational background?
Sure. 1973 to 82, I studied medicine and received my doctorate at the University of Paris in France. Internship followed that at a hospital in Paris, Saint-Anne's, and also at the American Hospital of Paris. It was followed by a medical surgical internship at a hospital in West Africa in Lomé. Then I did my psychiatric residency at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. Do you want me to continue with the professional experience?
Let me just ask you another question. Are you currently a licensed psychiatrist?
I am.
And can you please explain your professional experiences?
Yes. I will add that I'm licensed, but also board certified in psychiatry, general psychiatry and forensic psychiatry. So my professional experience, I've been a staff psychiatrist at a community mental health center in Alexandria, Virginia. I've been in private practice in Washington, D.C., general and forensic psychiatry. I am currently the clinical associate or a clinical associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at George Washington University. And I have been a profiler of world leaders in the behavioral unit of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Can you please tell us a little bit about your private practice and the types of clients you see?
Yes, I see individuals, families, couples, and people all across the socioeconomic spectrum. I have also on a pro bono volunteer basis worked with individuals who have following a disaster. For example, in Haiti, I was there after the earthquake. I was in Houston after Katrina. And I have also been a volunteer for Physicians for Human Rights, evaluating the credibility of victims of torture who are seeking political asylum here in the U.S.
And Dr. Van Susteren, do you serve on any committees?
I do. I have, these are selected committees, some of them current, some of them have been in the past. The Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard School of Public Health. I am a board member of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, co-founder of Climate Psychiatry Alliance and Climate Psychology Alliance, Equality Maryland, and I have to add Eco America, or the board members will not be happy with me.
Have you received any awards for your work, Dr. Van Susteren?
I have. I am a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and I've been honored for my work in the community by the Washington Psychiatric Society.
Dr. Van Susteren, have you done any work on the subject of climate change and mental health specifically?
Yes, I have.
And do you have any publications in this area?
I do. I can start, if you would like, from first of all, I have a book, Emotional Inflammation, which is featured on the monitor there. And it describes how people are affected by anxiety, turmoil over social conditions, and what we can do about it. I've also, as you can see, our children face a term that I've dubbed pre-traumatic stress from worries about climate change. That's been published in the British Medical Journal. And also in 2013, I'm a contributing author to the paper Assessing Dangerous Climate Change Required Reductions of Carbon Emissions to Protect Children, Young People, and Future Generations.
And what research projects are you currently working on?
I am currently working on a number of different projects. One of them is a survey that is coming out probably late this year, early next year, of 16,000 U.S. young people, 16 to 25, to assess their climate distress. And I am working on a project called the Ecopsychopedia, which we're going to have to change the name. It's too complicated. It's not psycho. It's psyche, even though psycho might be more descriptive, but Ecopsychopedia, it is a collaborative work that I'm doing with my colleagues, and it offers opportunities for people to speak about climate and mental health. I also have a book that's coming out soon, Climate in Your Mind, that I have been the principal, I am the editor of, and have contributed most of, or a good deal of the writing to, also with my colleagues.
Do you give public presentations about your work on climate change? And
I have given hundreds of presentations on this work.
Can you give us a few examples?
Yes.
You know, just a few.
I was at Harvard at their Planetary Health Conference in February. These are educational presentations, so they've sort of been selected for academic institutions, but it's not just academic institutions that I speak to, but this is what we've put together. University of Colorado, Denver School of Medicine, Mental Health Impacts, the Global Climate Emergency, Emory University Medical School, Climate Crisis and Clinical Medicine, George Washington University, Global Mental Health Seminar with my colleague Janet Lewis, Middlebury College, at the request of Bill McKibben to speak with his students, Building Resilience, Climate and Pandemic Traumas, Princeton, Witnessing Professionals and Climate Change, Harvard Global Health Institute, Human Health and a Changing Climate Symposium, in April 2017, Ohio Wesleyan Climate Change, Your Health and Your Role, and the University of Oregon School of Law, Climate in Court, with Dr. James Hansen and Professor Jeffrey Sachs.
Dr. Van Susteren, have you served as an expert in lawsuits before?
I have. Yes, it's been a number of years since I have been involved in court cases, forensic cases. But I have, yes.
Do you think that your testimony today will assist the court in understanding the evidence in this case?
Yes.
Are you charging the plaintiffs for your time?
No.
Would you consider yourself an advocate for the plaintiffs?
That is a very important concept for us to underscore and understand. Advocate, my 4 years of Latin, means to speak for someone else. So I am here speaking for the children. And it should not be confused with someone who is a zealot. A zealot is a person who holds particular beliefs, irrespective of what the science or the facts might say. There can be personal biases which they pursue and push onto others. So I am here as an advocate, speaking for the children. Clearly, my experience, my expertise, weight of what I have to say is what is lending support to the validity of what we are hearing ourselves from the plaintiffs, and what the science, of course, and voluminous materials tell us.
Dr. Van Susteren, do you believe that your participation as an expert in this case is consistent with the American Psychiatric Association Principles of Medical Ethics, a portion of which are displayed here on the screen?
Indeed, I do, and it's a very, very important concept. It tells physicians, we're instructed, nihil nocere, like, first of all, do no harm. But it is also a healing art, and especially as a psychiatrist, where you have people coming in and they're hurting, and you have to help them unpack why they're hurting and encourage them to engage in behavioral changes that will make a difference now, and especially down the road. But that doesn't just mean people who show up in your office, as you can see in our canon of ethics. It means that we use what we've had the privilege of enjoying, which is an incredible education. We have the responsibility to share that where we're needed. And that's the way I feel about being here today.
What are the primary bases for your opinions that you'll offer today, Dr. Van Susteren?
First of all, I've had 30 years of clinical experience. And, you know, easiest way to describe that is, who would you rather have operating on you, a first-year resident or an experienced surgeon? I got to tell you, after tens of thousands of interactions between people, between me and other people, you learn what outcomes are. You understand credibility. You watch for a number of different signals. And it's one of the key issues that is cited in psychiatry books that leads to a qualified practitioner. So I've also been a leading expert in the field of climate and mental health. I don't know if you want me to get into the details of that, but if you ask me, I will. I'm experienced as a behavioral profiler, as I mentioned earlier, of world leaders with the Central Intelligence Agency. I've done personal research, and I've collaborated with other very gifted mental health professionals. I have scientific publications about mental health and climate change. And of course, what marks us all the most is the testimony of the plaintiffs here in these last few days. And I've also looked at their declarations and complaints.
We've marked as exhibit P315 a list of citations referenced in your expert report, and I'd like to move that into evidence at this time, please.
No objection.
P315 is admitted.
Dr. Van Susteren, you said you've been, let me rephrase that. Dr. Van Susteren, have you been in court this week watching the plaintiffs testify?
Yes.
And you said you reviewed the declarations that the plaintiffs filed?
Yes.
Are any of the plaintiffs your patients?
They are not.
Are you here today to diagnose any of the plaintiffs?
No.
Are you suggesting a treatment plan for any of the plaintiffs?
No.
Have you performed any psychological testing of the plaintiffs?
No.
To render your opinions in this case, was testing or diagnosis or treatment plan necessary?
No.
So what are the primary data points that you rely on for your opinions about the plaintiffs?
Well, first of all, it is what people tell you. First thing you learn in medicine is listen to the patient. These are not my patients. They're plaintiffs, obviously. Listen to what they say. Obviously, if you have a patient who comes into the office and says, you know, I'm concerned about Martians landing in my backyard, you're going to think, and so there's a little bit, obviously, a reserve of trying to figure out what that's going to mean. But in this case, what we have are individuals speaking about their feelings that reflect the science, voluminous amounts of science that have well established that harms are being perpetrated. And so I am relying on the voluminous amount of science, my personal experience with cause and effect as a clinician, and with the testimony that is consistent with that body of information.
Have you met some of the plaintiffs?
I have.
And did you do assessments of some of the plaintiffs in this case that is currently subject to a confidential protective order?
I did.
And you're not going to offer any testimony today about the content of those meetings or the material contained in your assessments subject to the protective order.
That's correct. Right.
Dr. Van Susteren, were the opinions expressed in your expert report based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty?
Yes.
And will you please answer my questions today to that same standard?
Yes, I will.
Your Honor, at this point, I'd like to offer Dr. Lisa Van Susteren as an expert.
In psychiatry and climate change?
In psychiatry and climate change, yes, please.
All right. Yes, she's an expert.
May I just add the mental health and physical health impacts of climate change. I'm not a climate scientist, just to be specific that it's...
Thanks for the clarification. Should have said that.
Dr. Van Susteren, we've heard testimony earlier this week from Dr. Lori Byron about how youth are more vulnerable to the physical impacts of climate change. From your mental health perspective, are children uniquely vulnerable to climate change?
Yes, they are.
And can you please explain how?
In a number of ways. First of all, kids are dependent on the behavior and decisions, choices of adults. So they have to often submit or respond to or experience all of those decisions. So they're more vulnerable in that way, whether those decisions are good decisions or bad decisions. They also have brains and bodies that are just developing. And so many of the impacts of extreme weather events, particularly the traumas, because the traumas are and psychological, but they are very dependent on the impacts of those events. And we can talk about ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences of children, and where it is well delineated how and why kids are more vulnerable. And in addition, a young person has a much longer runway of whatever happens to us, as adults from climate trauma and climate issues is certainly sobering and problematic, but it's not going to be the intensity, nor the frequency of those extreme weather events. And indeed, there is a study which I've mentioned, and I believe it has been spoken about here earlier, is that children born today are expected to be subjected to at least 7 times the episodes of extreme weather events compared to adults.
What do you see when children are exposed to repeated traumatic events?
First of all, what's noteworthy is that you can have either acute events, ideally if a person or a child is exposed to an acute event, maybe it's a tornado or something, and maybe the feelings over time pass. But of course, maybe they don't. Maybe what happens is that a person, a child, continues to harbor fears about tornadoes, for example, or other weather events. And so it becomes a chronic trauma. But what's significant, especially significant when we talk about traumatic events, is exposure to those events are repeated, so that a person is not constantly, but repetitional stress and the most physical and psychological harm.
Let's turn now to discuss some of the specific mental health impacts that can result from climate change. I'd like to direct your attention to a chart on the screen. If you could please describe this and take your time walking us through it.
Sure. This is a thumbnail sketch of some of the harms that accrue from climate change impacts on mental health. And it is just a thumbnail. It's so that people can sort of get an overview. It is not comprehensive, but it's useful. And starting on the left, extreme weather events. As I mentioned earlier, you can have post-traumatic stress disorder. In other words, the stress doesn't just disappear after a climate event, but it persists. And anxiety and depression, pretty clear that people have a range of emotional responses to unexpected challenges from the world around them, and grief and loss. Obviously, you know, when you, let's say you lose your house, or it's blown away, burned down, flooded, maybe you lose your possessions, your pets, you know, where you live is disrupted, et cetera. That's going to create enormous grief and loss. And we're seeing a lot of, we meaning professionals like me, are seeing this in many professional practices. And of course, we're seeing it very much in the literature. High temperature, mood disorders, yes, anxiety, aggressive behavior. I can go into the details of that. Increased mortality, of course, among mental health patients. I can go into the details there. And then long-term climate change. And this is that sense, that's where you really, the rubber really hits the road, is when kids are envisioning what's going to happen in the future. It's something that I've dubbed, I think I said, pre-traumatic stress. But again, we can go into that. But this is where you find the most difficulty trying to recover. And then changing livelihoods, resource shortage, disrupted infrastructure. Well, we are seeing these numbers, increased suicide rates, increased violence and crime, reduced community cohesion, worse access to mental health care. I think those are all things that we can deduce as people are no longer finding themselves in the communities that are either there and accessible or functioning.
Were you here earlier this week for the testimony of Dr. Steve Running?
I was.
Were you here for the testimony of Dr. Kathy Whitlock?
I was.
And is the climate science you heard them testify about something you're generally familiar with? Albeit I understand you're not a climate scientist yourself.
That is correct. I am familiar with it.
Is it your understanding that these types of climate impacts that you were just describing are becoming increasingly common in Montana?
Yes.
And did you listen to the testimony of Dr. Lori Byron?
I did.
As a doctor who went to medical school, are you familiar with the physical health impacts of climate change on
Yes.
people? So today we're not here to talk about the physical health impacts, but is there a connection between the physical health impacts and the mental health impacts?
Let me say that I will permit myself at times to talk about the physical impacts because I am a physician. And at times it's important to understand the physical impacts, to understand the psychological impacts. But there is no such thing as physical impacts of climate change alone. Every physical injury, loss, et cetera, this is not a newsflash, carries with it an attendant emotional toll. And of course, when we're distressed emotionally, we know very well that that can affect us physically. It is a two-way street, and it has been talked about for centuries. The Romans called it mens sana in corpore sano, a healthy mind in a healthy body. And we know this instinctively from our own personal experience.
So I want to take a step back now, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about when your work on climate change and mental health really started.
Yes. I ran for the United States Senate in 2005, 2006. Obviously, here today to tell you that I did not win. But I learned a lot, and I was initially focused basically on healthcare. Particularly what was painful was imagining people suffering from stem cell research, which was being blocked. I was also very focused on veterans affairs, and in particular, I was focused on, and I'm perhaps we'll get a laugh out of this, maybe not, but I felt that the United States Senate could use a good psychiatrist. So, as you know, I have said I did not prevail. But in the aftermath, what happened was during the course of my work running, I became increasingly aware of climate issues. I had heard about global warming, but it just hadn't been front and center. And then I started to focus on it, and I realized the magnitude of the problem and the urgency. And so sort of like climate issues found me, I didn't find them. It's because of my ongoing awareness of where we were.
Did you convene any?
Yes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Did you convene any conferences around this time?
I did. In 2009, I co-convened with the Vice President of the National Wildlife Federation, my good friend Kevin Coyle, a conference which was global warming, the effects of global warming in the United States, and why the U.S. Healthcare system is not prepared.
Did the conference result in a report of any kind?
It did. It took us or me a while being kind of fussy with the language. So the publication came out in 2012.
Is what I've displayed on the screen a copy of the publication?
It is.
Could you just read the title of the report for us, please?
The Psychological Effects of Global Warming on the United States, with the tagline, and why the U.S. mental health care system is not adequately prepared.
What were some of the findings of this report?
I'll read here. Global warming in the coming years will foster public trauma, depression, violence, alienation, substance abuse, suicide, psychotic episodes, post-traumatic stress disorders, and many other mental health-related conditions.
Were there any findings in this report specific about children?
Yes, there were. And I will read it if you would like. But in particular, we signaled that at that time America's 70 million children will not only suffer long-term effects from climate change, but will also experience reactions, acute reactions, to natural disasters and extreme weather events. And, of course, this hasn't changed.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, it's been almost 15 years since this conference. Have these psychological effects of global warming that you were studying about and meeting about in 2009 and in this report in 2012 been borne out since then?
I was hoping you would say or would ask me if they changed, because I was going to say, yes, they're worse.
How so?
First of all, there's that famous line Groucho Marx that says, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? A number of years ago, it was sometimes hard for people generally to believe that the Earth's climate systems could be turned upside down. But now we're seeing it with our own eyes. The kids have told you this week very compellingly about how their world is different. And they have told us how this is worrisome. We're now finding programs in schools, the curricula, that talk to kids about climate science. They see it on the internet. They do not live in a cave. They know all of these things, all of these things. They know many of these issues. They are very attuned to the fact that of what I and others have referred to as intergenerational injustice, that they are suffering consequences that will be spinning out of their control, and they have firsthand knowledge. In addition,
have professional organizations, let's say the American Psychological Association, recognized the connection between climate change and mental health?
Indeed, it has. The American Psychological Association, by the way, when we had our conference, on the global warming in the U.S. The head of the American Psychological Association was there. We had a member of the CDC, not to insist, but a Nobel Prize winner. People were head of the Anxiety and Disorders Association of America. Real high-level people. I mean, very sophisticated and knowledgeable. And so I'm particularly grateful to the American Psychological Association for looking at this issue, being willing to listen way back in 2009, and eventually to come out with their own report.
Are you a contributing author to this report?
I am.
And for the record, can you please identify the report that we're talking about?
Yes, it's the mental health, it's mental health and our changing climate, the impacts, implications, and guidance from the American Psychological Association 2017 publication.
Did you rely on this report in forming your opinions?
I did, in part.
Would you consider this report to be reliable?
Yes.
And is this the type of report that mental health professionals would routinely rely upon?
Yes. It has been widely disseminated and responded to.
Can you talk us through some of the findings of this report, please?
Sure. Climate change, induced extreme weather, changing weather patterns, damaged food and water resources, and polluted air impact human mental health. Increased levels of stress and distress from these factors can also put strains on social relationships and even have impacts on physical health, such as memory loss, sleep disorders, immune suppression, and changes in digestion. And we'll get at that a little bit later.
And specifically to kids, what did this report find?
Climate impacts may have long-term and even in permanent effects, such as changing the developmental potential and trajectory of a child.
Your Honor, at this time, I'd like to move this report into evidence, which has been marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit 83.
Object on the basis of hearsay, Your Honor.
May I?
Well, we've been letting reports in quite a bit. I'm going to let in. I'll admit P83.
Thank you, Your Honor. Was this the only report prepared by the American Psychological Association on climate change?
No, there is an updated version in 2021, which shows you how rapidly evolving and the concern for them to put out another report in such short order.
And can you please identify what's being displayed on the screen right now?
Mental health and our changing climate impacts, inequities, responses.
And is this
the American Psychological Association 2021?
And were you a contributing author to this report?
I was.
And did you rely on this report in preparing your opinions?
I did in part.
And I assume, like the other report, this is a report that mental health professionals would routinely rely upon in your field?
Very much so.
Like you to please talk us through some of the findings in this report?
Sure. The evidence is unequivocal that exposure to climate and weather-related disasters has serious impacts on psychological well-being, and that the chronic impacts of climate change, such as higher temperatures and drought, also have significant negative effects on mental health. Research increasingly points to another psychological outcome of climate change: stress, anxiety, and debilitating worry about the present and future damage of higher global temperatures.
What's your takeaway from these two reports from the American Psychological Association?
That there is an abundance of literature in professional organizations of my ilk, meaning mental health, and that this material is reliable, and it is of grave concern, and it is showing that our children are at deep risk. the impacts of climate disruption.
Thank you. And at this point, Your Honor, this report is marked as P84. I'd like to move it into evidence.
No objection, Your Honor.
All right. Overrule. P84 is admitted.
Dr. Van Susteren, we've talked about the American Psychological Association. What about the American Psychiatric Association?
The American Psychiatric Association has swung into action, and they are now taking very seriously the emotional toll of climate disruption on the mental health of individuals and, of course, young people and children. The American Psychiatric Association has now organized a special committee to study and look at what we should do regarding climate disruption. We have had a number of, over the last several years, of presentations. I've presented it a number of times, and so have my colleagues, to bring the issue of climate and mental health to our colleagues. And we've also been involved in commenting in the media on climate and mental health.
Are you a member of the American Psychiatric Association?
I am.
Do you know if the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, has weighed in on the connection between climate change and mental health?
Yes, it has.
Are you familiar with this report, the IPCC AR6?
I am familiar with it.
And in particular, Chapter 7, Health, Well-being, and the Changing Structure of Communities?
Yes.
And can you please talk through some of the findings of this report?
Sure. So since AR5, the previous edition of the IPCC report, new evidence and awareness of current impacts and projected risks of climate change on health, well-being, migration, and conflict have emerged, including greater evidence of the detrimental impacts of climate change on mental health. And it was reached, as Dr. Running noted the other day in so many other domains, with very high confidence.
And what about this next finding, Dr. Van Susteren?
Climate change is expected to have adverse impacts on well-being and to further threaten mental health, also with very high confidence.
And specifically with respect to children, what did the report find?
Children are particularly vulnerable to climate change impacts. Children and adolescents are particularly vulnerable to post-traumatic stress after extreme weather events. The effects may even be long-lasting, with impacts on their adult functioning.
And at this point, Your Honor, I'd like to move into evidence, Plaintiff's Exhibit P127, this IPCC chapter, which is just different than some of the other IPCC reports that have come in already.
Same objection, Your Honor.
P127 is admitted.
Dr. Van Susteren, are you familiar with the U.S. National Climate Assessments?
I am.
Do you know if the most recent National Climate Assessment has talked about mental health and climate change?
I am aware, yes.
Can you describe generally what the National Climate Assessment has found?
As with these other publications, the National Climate Assessment underscores the mental health emotional toll of climate disruption on individuals in the United States particularly, but it does highlight the impacts on children and that these impacts are prolonged and they are expected to cause over time increased harm to individuals.
Are you familiar with any Montana-specific reports on climate change and physical or mental health?
Yes, of course, climate change and human health, which in Montana, in this publication, also describes the impacts of climate disruption on mental health. harmful impacts, not just the impacts, how harmful the impacts are on our mental health.
And did you rely in part on this report informing your opinions?
I did in part, yes.
And this, just for the record, is marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit B31. It's already been admitted. And can you talk through a couple of the findings of this report specific to mental health, please?
Sure. The mental health impacts of climate change are profound and varied. Extreme weather events, prolonged heat and smoke, and environmental and societal change all affect mental health, including increasing feelings of disconnectedness and despair.
So we've done kind of a survey of the American psychological, psychiatric, and various governmental reports on climate change and mental health. Would you say there's a scientific consensus that climate change can harm the mental health of people, in particular children and youth?
Indisputably.
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the specific climate impacts that you previewed for us earlier and the impacts and the harms to mental health. So can we start with heat and how increasing heat and temperatures can impact mental health?
Sure. First of all, temperature, higher temperatures affect our cognition. And it's a fancy word for how well we can use our brains. And what we find is that when people are subjected to higher temperatures, that the accuracy of their work, for example, drops. The speed with which they can accomplish those tasks drops. And the general overall sophistication of their thinking is also compromised. We also know that heat and temperature are increased heat. And this is a particularly sobering reality, is linked to increased incidence of aggression. And in fact, we have very specific studies that show that for each standard deviation of temperature, and that can be just a couple of degrees, that doesn't have to be a huge variation, we see a 4% rise in violence between individuals and a 14% rise in violence between groups. And that's true of all ethnicities in all regions of the world. So what that means more assaults, more murders, more suicides, and of course, bringing it back home, there's a general problem with us and an irritability factor, an impatience factor. Those are all a sort of minimal consequences, but over time, those things, of course, have a cumulative toll. And this has been studied very, very carefully. We also see that individuals who have a pre-existing mental health disorder or some kind of mental health challenge see an exacerbation of their conditions. And just from my perspective as a practitioner, I know that we see people who are taking medication oftentimes are more compromised when the temperature goes up. Many of the medications that we take affect our ability to perspire. And so you are more likely to get people afflicted with some of the things that Dr. Byron talked about last time, including heat stroke. And so we've got more people showing up in ERs, et cetera, as they are exposed to higher temperatures. And furthermore, oftentimes population, some at least, who have major medical disorders, you know, their judgment is a little compromised. They don't always know enough to get out of the heat. So it's very widespread impact and deep.
And we heard Dr. Running and Dr. Willock talk about how temperatures are expected to increase in Montana. If temperatures do increase in the coming years, do you think that these types of injuries you were just describing will worsen or become more prevalent?
Yes.
I'd like to show you now what's been marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit P85, a chapter titled Psychological Impacts of Climate Change and Recommendations. Is this one of the chapters that you report, that you reviewed in forming your opinions in this case?
Yes, it is.
And are you the author of this chapter?
I am.
And was this published in the book Health of People, Health of the Planet, and Our Responsibility?
Yes, it was.
Do you consider this to be a reliable source?
Yes, I do.
I hope so.
I'll just say as a parenthetical that this was a production, a publication from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is a very old organization, and many of the authors are Nobel Prize winners, whom I share this space with, and they are recognized among the most well-known and respected experts in the fields.
And can you just share a couple of the findings of this chapter with regarding heat impacts?
Sure. Significant psychological stress is also associated with heat waves. With rising temperatures comes rising rates of aggression. Declining cognitive function could become increasingly problematic for those unable to escape heat.
And these are some of the impacts that result from rising temperatures, is that right?
That's correct.
Your Honor, at this point, I'd like to move into evidence, Plaintiff's Exhibit P85.
Objection is the cumulative evidence, Your Honor.
Sustained.
So we've also heard testimony this week, Dr. Van Susteren, about increasing drought conditions in Montana. Are drought conditions associated with any mental health impacts?
Yes, they are. And we can kind of tease out specific mental sort of responses, emotional responses. In general, you can say that anxiety, depression, et cetera. But there's something peculiarly associated to drought. And that is the sort of that comes, the consequences are going to get worse. So in addition to all of the general conditions that you can associate with emotional turmoil from unexpected or unpleasant, unwelcome conditions, it's that chronic despair. And it's important because what we are seeing and what has been well studied now is the link to suicide. It is very much in the literature, the medical literature. The number of suicides in, for example, farmers in India who are experiencing grievous drought, and ranchers in Western Australia. And those are studies that exist. And of course, people are going to do more research. So we will see increasingly, undoubtedly, the link to self-destructive behaviors.
We've also heard a lot of testimony this week, Dr. Van Susteren, from experts like Dr. Running and Dr. Whitlock about wildfires increasing in Montana. Is there a connection between wildfires and mental health impacts?
Yes, obviously there is. And wildfires, of course, are particularly traumatic. Without going into the wildfire smoke and how it affects us physically and emotionally, I'll just say the wildfires themselves. I think we saw those photos. I was particularly marked by a photo of Badge standing there with a fire in the hills right behind him. And I was thinking to myself, what would that be like? He was standing in front of his house with his little evacuation rescue packet, and wondering if when he turned the next time and returned to his, if he had to evacuate his neighborhood, if it'd be nothing but a moonscape. And the trauma of recognizing that all could be lost in an instant and to be surrounded by those fears as those hills are on fire, It is a particularly traumatic and enduringly traumatic event.
Does one need to experience an actual loss, say having your home burned down from a wildfire, to have mental health injuries?
Absolutely not. This is what we call secondary trauma. When you see other people suffering harms, we do experience trauma ourselves. And, you know, we're not potted plants here. Seeing other people suffer is out of empathic identification with a victim. It causes us secondary trauma. So we're not immune just because our own house didn't burn down. And remember, these kids have seen pictures of places that look like a cemetery of chimneys, houses burned to the ground, nothing but the chimney remaining.
Can the threat of loss alone sometimes be enough to cause mental health harms?
Indeed. And now everybody's a little bit different, but I think that sort of inchoate sense that in the future, bad things are going to happen. You know, it's one thing if you can have an experience and you think, okay, one in a million, this happened. I got to try to figure out how to put it behind me. There's some relief when you realize action's going to be taken. And so it helps you to recover and to heal. But when you realize, on the contrary, the future, how's the future going to be any different? What assurances are there? Are there any actions being taken that can suggest to me the future is going to be different? So, yes, the threat of future harm is particularly grievous.
And what about mental health harms from actually having to prepare to evacuate your home because of a wildfire?
Well, I mean, the sense that your life could change on a dime, everything that's familiar. I mean, even salmon's, you know, salmon go upstream to spawn. Home is a pretty important place. And to think that everything that you know, the memories that you have, the experiences with loved ones, maybe pets, and all of your belongings all of a sudden incinerated, and that you have to take a little tiny bag to suggest that your life is going to be now confined to some little space, pretty traumatic.
What about for those plaintiffs that have, well, not specific to the plaintiffs, sorry. What about just being surrounded by a wildfire smoke? Can that cause mental health impacts?
Well, yes, sure. It is very problematic. Wildfire smoke, and we'll get into it in, specifically when we look at air pollution. But the wildfire smoke and what it suggests, of course, is that there are that wildfires are surrounding you. And we saw what happened in the northeastern part of the U.S. just recently. But what it tells you is that the world is not a safe place. You can't go outside and breathe. The plaintiffs told us over and over again they can't go outside. And there's nothing as important to our health and our mental health as being able to breathe. I mean, we can go without water longer than we can go without oxygen. We're talking seconds. So it really spawns an enormous amount of anxiety. It makes people feel as if the world is out of control, or it can make them feel as if the world is out of control when that single most important thing that we need as humans is oxygen.
Do you think the mental health impacts from wildfire smoke would be any different for individuals with asthma or other respiratory diseases?
Indeed. People who have respiratory diseases, of course, asthma, et cetera, they are much more vulnerable to the impacts of smoke. And, of course, people who, you know, are outside typically having fun, just being kids and seeing their friends or engaged in recreational activities, et cetera, can't do it. We saw what happened with COVID when kids were locked up. This is not consistent with psychological health or well-being.
A moment ago, you mentioned air pollution. Is there anything else you want to add about air pollution and mental health?
There's a lot more I can add if we want to get to it. We're not jumping ahead. Air pollution in general can cause enormous physical damage. And I don't know if we want to get to that slide quite yet, in addition to psychological damage. But the wildfire smoke, because it compromises. Oh, there we go. Okay. So here's what's important to look at. And wildfire smoke has, especially way over on the right, you'll see the ultra-fine particulate matter. And that's what makes up the majority of the particulate matter in wildfire smoke. You can see this diagram shows in black where the impact of that particulate matter is when you breathe it in. Way over on the right, that ultra-fine particulate matter, as you can see, it courses through our entire body because it crosses the lungs, goes into the bloodstream, and then it also goes up your nose, takes a ride on the nerves in the nose, and goes directly into the brain and causes neuroinflammation. So here's what we see, and I'll talk first about the neuroinflammation and the brain impacts, and then I'll just repeat a little bit about physical impacts. But what is, first of all, when it goes through the entire body, anytime you have a foreign body, and that includes particulate matter, it sets the body up for inflammation. Inflammation is the substrate. In other words, it's the terrain for any kind of illness or disease. So when it goes into the brain, what it causes is neuroinflammation. And this is what we're seeing. We are seeing an increased risk associated with Parkinson's disease, with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and with dementias of all natures. We are also seeing an increased risk of psychosis in adolescents. And we are seeing in classic psychiatric illness, we are seeing an increase in association to bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. We are also seeing, and this is increasingly well studied, in emergency rooms, we are seeing people showing up complaining of having anxiety attacks. That's the, when that oxygen, when you don't get oxygen, boy, can that trigger anxiety quickly. And with threats to commit suicide. And those numbers are out there. And we're going to be seeing those numbers more as time goes on, unfortunately. If you would like, I can just briefly review some of the impacts. I've covered it for the impacts of pollution generally on the body as it circulates throughout the body.
Are you referring to physical health impacts there?
Pardon me?
Are you referring to physical health impacts to the body?
I was referring to the physical health impacts, but I think we can incorporate those into what happens with adverse childhood experiences, but I can say that, as I said earlier, that inflammation generally sets you up for immune problems. It sets you up for cardiovascular problems, and it sets you up for memory, of course, problems. And it can affect our ability to sleep. It can cause sleep problems, et cetera. But what's noteworthy, and this is that there are sometimes immediate effects that you can see, but it's not necessarily that you see the immediate effects. Many times, physical insults are the opening salvo to the creation of the disease. So these prolonged exposures are what are especially damaging.
Dr. Van Sessen, we've heard testimony this week about adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. So I'm not going to ask you to describe those for us again, but I'm wondering if you could just address specifically how ACEs are related to mental health injuries in children.
Sure. One of the important aspects of well understanding ACEs is something that wasn't necessarily, I think, well understood before. And that is that there is a lag time between an insult or a trauma in this particular case. And when you see some of those impacts on us physically, so when we've talked about cardiovascular, for example, impacts, you don't see those right away. It's over time. So for children, the more traumatic events you experience, the more likely you will have and the cumulative toll of the adverse childhood experiences. And just to cut to the chase, the more you are affected, the more likely you are to have illnesses generally, and that includes, of course, mental and physical, and the more likely you are to have an early death. And this has been very well studied and substantiated, and it is what will befall young people exposed to repeated traumas.
Can you tell us what happens on the brain level when there's exposure to repeated trauma or climate stress?
Yes, and I'll not make this wonky. I'll try to make it real easy to understand, but this is, of course, as you can guess, an image of the brain. And I'm going to talk about it, I hope, in simple terms, and that is that you have pointed out your prefrontal cortex. That's like the situation room. That's the part of your brain that gets data from all the rest of the kind of yellow part of your brain telling you where you are, what you're supposed to do. It evaluates things with respect to your conscience, your good judgment about the conditions and all the rest. So that's the situation room, and it's flooded with data all the time. Now we got also the amygdala, and that's the fight or flight center some of you may have heard about. And that's the center that achieves prominence when you're under stress or threat of stress. And so what happens when people are threatened and under stress over long periods of time or for short periods of time? If it's a short period of time, that's the way we're made. We're supposed to respond in an acute situation with the proper response. But when that red light on the dashboard is on all the time telling you that you are under threat, here's what happens. The situation room, the lights go down on the situation room, and the lights go up on the fight or flight center, the amygdala. It's sort of like you go from having the situation room in the driver's seat to having the fight or flight center in charge. And think about it. We've all been under stress. We know we have to call back, say, look, I'm really sorry. I was just irritated because of this or under stress because of that. So think about it, though, when this is chronic and you have some of the impacts, the behavioral changes that you saw in that pyramid and that were talked about the other day, what happens is when it's the amygdala that's in the driver's seat, the fight or flight, you're saying stuff that maybe better not to say. You might be impulsive. You might be engaging in dangerous behaviors, misreading, etc. So you got the what happens is you got the prefrontal cortex, that's the situation room, pushed out of the driver's seat. Now we got an individual driving with the amygdala at the wheel. And it's not a pretty, it can be a very, not very pretty ride.
Approximately when does the prefrontal cortex become fully developed?
It's after the age of adulthood. And it always reminds me of when parents have turned to their children and say, what were you thinking? And the kid will think, well, I wasn't thinking anything. That's right, because that prefrontal cortex, that situation room, doesn't really mature completely until about moral scientists say 25. And it's so important because that's where we can have nuanced sense of judgment, where we have a moral sort of fiber, where we look at what others might need, and it lines up with what our conscience tells us to do. So, you know, we need people who are more attuned to nuances, empathic, and have a good conscience.
And can exposure to this long-term stress have damaging body or damaging harms on especially young people's bodies?
It does. And Dr. Byron referred to it the other day. What is instructive is to note that these impacts can be delayed and mostly are delayed. You don't get the appearance of cardiovascular disease from stress. We know it, high blood pressure, heart rate, etc. You don't see that until down the road. But there are cardiovascular impacts to chronic stress. We know that. There are impacts on our immune system. One of the things that is the cause of this stress is something called cortisol, which is a steroid. And everybody knows that when you take, you've got an organ transplant, you take steroids to reduce your body's immune system ability to fight. So what happens is under these conditions of chronic stress, exposed to steroids, what you have are people predisposed to illnesses and to cancers. We also have impacts on our hormones many times, and this is really very problematic, of course, for some people, is that it affects fertility because it affects our hormones. And you'll often hear about people having trouble becoming pregnant, and it can be the stress of those, that extra dose of steroids. So, and as I said, sleep and so many other conditions.
Are youth more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and specifically mental health impacts because of
it? Cumulative. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I'll let him finish the question.
I'm just wondering specifically if youth are more vulnerable to mental health impacts.
Oh, yes, because the whole point is ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. This is the depiction, really, of what happens with that cumulative toll of stress. So this is quintessentially regarding children. The answer is a resounding yes. And, of course, the younger you are, the more likely you are to have the cumulative toll of stress.
Okay, I'd like to move on to a new topic. Is it your opinion, Dr. Van Susteren, that the plaintiffs in this case are experiencing some impacts to their mental health consistent with those described in the scientific literature?
Yes.
Objection, Your Honor. Lack of foundation. Dr. Van Susteren has already testified that she is not diagnosed with plans or anything.
I'm not.
Like a little bit more foundation. I think she told us some of this, but how she's making these determinations about these plaintiffs.
Dr. Van Susteren, have you heard anything from the plaintiffs, either the language in their complaint, the declarations, or their testimony this week to suggest that they're experiencing any mental health impacts related to climate change?
Yes.
Now, I understand you wanted to talk through a few examples of that. We could do that briefly.
Sure. We have here, first of all, Ricky, and you've all heard in the courtroom in this last week that Ricky has very much suffered from consequences of drought. There have been financial problems as the viability of the ranch is compromised. There have been dead animals on her land, her problem seeing that the animals are properly hydrated, etc. And she has said that she feels a profound sense of abandonment as a result of the impacts of the climate disruption and the fact that the defendants have not taken proper action. And there's much more to say about Ricky, but we'll move on instead. Grace, of course, has said that she watches coal trains pass by her house, and she knows that they are the etiology or the root cause of burning coal is the root cause of the problems. I can't imagine how that must feel, being traumatized every day looking at these things. And she feels betrayed by her government as a result, by the defendants as a result. And she has said very compellingly, and I really noticed how these plaintiffs love this state so much. It's amazing, being the mother of teenagers in not a so distant past, that these kids talk so glowingly of how much they love their state. So she looks at those glaciers disappearing and feels terrified. We've talked about the physical and we've talked about the emotional connection to the land. But what really is so sublime and exciting, I think, for us, perhaps at least me, not as wedded to the land as indigenous, is to hear Sariel talk about the spiritual connection. Her ancestors are buried there. Ideally, if her land is protected and not ruined, she will be. This is her lifeblood. This is who she is. You take that away from a person, you take that person's identity away from him or her. This has a profound impact. And we saw yesterday, Sariel started to cry when she noted that the community rallied around her to provide the money that was necessary for her to get a first-rate education. And it marked me so, as a profiler especially, that it was the idea that a community was supportive of her that would bring her to tears. And she went like this. And as I say, as a profiler, those are profoundly noteworthy gestures to see the effects of what community can mean. I won't go into further details. Micah. Of course, Micah has told us about his having been imprisoned in his basement because of smoke. And he's also told us very glowingly, and this is embedded in it, the sense of loss that can come, is that when he's out on the trail running around, when he's not having to stay in the house because of the wildfire smoke, he doesn't even want to listen to music. It's the music of the forest, the beautiful trees, it's nature. These kids love this state, and what it provides for them is something that is extraordinarily noteworthy, and it also implies what they stand to lose. They know it too. They look at those trees, and it is indisputable in my mind, and they've said so too, who's next, what's next. So Micah, by the way, has been suffering with the climate, he said, since he was 4 years old when he watched the movie Chasing Ice. So this is the leitmotif of Micah's life, is trying to avoid the threat and fear of climate disruption. A badge named after a badger to medicine, and he has described for us the importance of his being able to connect with his family around the experience of being in a healthy Montana. They even hunt and fish for their livelihoods. This is a unique experience and a potentially unique loss. And you may recall that Badge showed us not only the fires behind him, but the fact that the area after which he was named was nothing but, I guess, I saw pine trees 100 feet tall, he said, that were gray. And that was the redolent place that he'd been named after. Imagine what that does to you. Olivia, well, we just heard Olivia. Olivia has spoken to us very, very compellingly. She has expressed herself that she is in despair. She has also said how hopeful she is, that she really hangs on to the possibility of hope, and that's the antidote to despair. But what is of particular concern to me is when I hear how hard she tries to reduce her carbon footprint by staying out of the car, by being on her bike, and things like that. And I think, my God, surely there are upstream impacts that we as adults, hearing how much she is suffering from this, will want to come in and protect her.
And finally?
Finally, Claire. Claire has told us, and this was, I think, one of and among the more arresting stories, and I've heard a lot of arresting stories, but in middle school, and just think about what kind of cynicism in a middle schooler. She raises money for solar panels and says that they've reached their cap at a certain point, and the rest of the money that she's raised can't be used to install solar panels for renewable energy, but instead has to be thrown back into the kitty, presumably for the use of fossil fuels to continue. She also has talked about the beauty of glaciers and the potential loss. And she has said that she feels terrified. And I believe, as with Olivia, this sense of whether or not, and this is something which I didn't mention about Olivia, but the quandary about whether or not it's right to bring children into a world like this. Well, what an unnatural dilemma for a young person. Surely people can make their own choice, but to have foisted on them a world that they can't depend on to be safe, and so they're wondering if it's ethical. So, you know, this is just a quick superficial thumbnail sketch of the range, abandonment, betrayal, despair, terror, very real consequences from these plaintiffs and from the state, the experience of living in this state that they love and they know is under severe threat.
Thank you. And moving to another topic now, I'm wondering, are you familiar with the Montana Environmental Policy Act, or MEPA, limitation?
Yes, I am familiar with it.
And what's your understanding of the MEPA limitation?
That it expressly forbids agencies and policymakers from considering the impacts of climate change when reviewing environmental projects.
And is it your opinion that plaintiffs' mental health injuries are related to the climate change exception to MEPA?
Yes, I do.
Is there a term for when governments let children down in this way?
There is. It is called institutional betrayal. And think about it. Universities, academic institutions, churches, and of course the state, have special responsibilities, because with the privilege of power comes the responsibilities to protect the people that are within its purview. And picking out the state specifically, it is the job. This is the social contract. We pay taxes. We do this. We do all these other things, and we respond to the requirements of government because of that special relationship, that institutional power that we have. So here we have an instance where the power of the state to take care of these children, to protect them, which is essential. It is the core of the presence of the state in their lives and in all of our lives. Instead of protecting them, they're increasing the dangers.
Has there been any research connecting the concept of institutional betrayal to climate change?
Indeed, there has. I had published in 2021 with co-authors in The Lancet, which is acknowledged to be a premier medical journal, a study on 10,000 young people ages 16 to 25 around the world, 10 countries. And we measured there in this survey their climate distress. And here's what we found. I'm just going to tease out four little pieces that I think are most relevant. And that is, number one, 3/4 of those 10,000 kids were very concerned about climate. Almost half of them said that it affected their daily lives. More than half say they feel doomed. And two-thirds of those 10,000 kids lay the blame firmly at the feet of government.
Do you think that any of the plaintiffs in this case feel these feelings of institutional betrayal as a result of the MEPA limitation?
I don't feel it. They've said it.
Dr. Van Susteren, are you aware that the MEPA limitation was recently amended?
I'm aware that MEPA was recently amended. I believe the limitation remains in place. Is that correct?
Close enough.
Close enough.
Does the existence of this MEPA limitation bolster your opinions about related to the emotional impacts that the plaintiffs have described experiencing here?
I'll just try to be succinct and say yes.
In your opinion, Dr. Van Susteren, what would be the most effective remedy to help prevent further psychological harm to these plaintiffs?
Objection. Call for legal conclusion.
Well, I guess I'm interpreting as not a legal remedy necessarily. What's the remedy? I don't know.
I'll try to rephrase the question. If Dr. Van Susteren, in your opinion, what would be the most effective way to help the plaintiffs meant to help minimize or have the plaintiffs feel better about the emotional impacts that they've described feeling?
There really is only one remedy, and that's to address the root cause.
And when you say address the root cause, you mean, what do you mean by the root cause?
It's the promotion of fossil fuels and the rulings within the state that expressly prohibit consideration of climate impacts.
Can't mental health experts provide services to improve mental health conditions?
It's sort of like saying if the roof leaks, should you just buy more paint so you can cover up where it's leaking? Yeah, you can do little things on the outside, but it doesn't change anything. It might present a bit of a Band-Aid, but that's not going to heal any of the conditions.
Earlier, Dr. Van Susteren, you mentioned that you're an author of the 2003 paper Assessing Dangerous Climate Change. Is that right?
That's correct.
And did you rely on this paper in forming your opinions in this case?
I did.
And is this the type of study reasonably relied upon by experts in your field?
Indeed it is.
And was it peer-reviewed?
Up one side of the street and down the other.
Can you please identify the key conclusions of this paper?
Yes. That we must reach zero emissions by 2050, and that we must reach 350 parts per million as a result of our work by the end of the century. For our, and I will underscore this word, salvation.
Your Honor, this paper has been marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit P21, and I would like to move it into evidence at this time.
Objection, cumulative.
Your Honor, if I may, this is really one of the gold standard papers for identifying the standard for protecting the environment, human health, physical health, emotional health. It's been peer-reviewed. It's been authored by Dr. Van Susteren, other leading climate scientists like Dr. James Hansen, and I believe it also qualifies as a learned treatise.
All right, I will admit P21.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one final question, Dr. Van Susteren. In your opinion, how will the outcome of this case impact plaintiffs' mental health?
It will be determinative, frankly, in many ways. We are at a fork in the road. The kids know what is at stake, and they know what we have to do. And you have on one side of the spectrum that we will be headed towards further damage, darkness, challenges, and trauma, and the attendant emotional toll that comes with that. Or on the other hand, I believe that if they prevail here in this case today, that that sense of hope that all these plaintiffs have been talking about, and the belief that there are reasons to hope, because hope is not something you pound the table. Hope comes from having legitimate reasons to think things are going to get better. So it's a night and day impact on their mental health. Either things are going to get worse, and they will increasingly sense the feeling of helplessness, or instead, here we are bringing to them the possibility that the necessary changes are going to be made, and their lives will be able to have the healthy, joyful character that they seek and certainly deserve.
Thank you, Dr. Van Susteren. I have no further questions.
Ross.
Briefly, good afternoon, Dr. Van Susteren.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to Montana again. Just picking up where we left off a moment ago, is it your impression that the plaintiff's mental health is the core issue of this case?
It is a factor. Yes, it's the case is the actions of the defendants and the impact of the deeds and policies of the defendants on the mental health of these plaintiffs.
And in other words, what I'm getting at, it's not just a side issue. It's the essence of why we're here, as far as your understanding is concerned.
Well, could you give me an indication of what you mean by a side issue?
Well, I don't know if I can do it without confusing things further, so I'll leave it at that. You said at the outset that you have not diagnosed any of the plaintiffs with any of the things you've talked about here today. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
And have you appeared in a court of law before and testified like you are today about the mental health of anyone without having made a diagnosis?
Yes, I believe I have.
Can you give me an example?
Yes. A case in which a person was claiming emotional damages after a surgical error, and another emotional damages with respect to a botched biopsy. Another one was a sexual harassment case. Those are the three that come to mind.
In any of those, were you advocating for the damages that the party was alleging, or were you on the other side of the case?
I've been on both sides.
Well, in those three cases specifically, Dr. Van Susteren, did you discuss the alleged damages? In all three of those, I think your testimony is you discussed the alleged damages without having made a diagnosis on any of them.
Correct.
And were you doing that on behalf of those parties on their side of the case?
Well, no, in the first case, I was working for the defendants. In the second case, I was working for the plaintiffs. In the third case that I had referred to, I was working for the defendant.
So in two of the three, you were called upon to testify in opposition to their claim of damages.
Correct.
But in another one, you were on their side. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's correct. That's my record, to the best of my ability. It's been a number of years.
Are there ethical rules for your profession that pertain to when you should make a diagnosis versus when you don't need to, if you're going to be discussing the condition of a certain individual?
I am not aware that there are other than that there are prescribed ethical considerations. The ethical consideration is that you, as the expert, speak the truth as far as you know it. That's the ethical consideration. And I've turned cases down where I didn't believe that I could be that I could be honest about what I was hearing and finding. So I would not take a case under those circumstances.
Did I hear you correctly at the beginning, and please tell me if I'm mistaken, that you believe you are an advocate for the plaintiffs in this case? Is that an accurate statement?
Let me put it this way so that we make sure that it doesn't get tarnished in any way with any potential to impute something. Advocate is literally to speak for. So I do believe that my role here is to speak for the plaintiffs.
About their mental health specifically, fair?
Not their mental health specifically. It's specifically about how the actions of the state affect their mental health.
Correct. To describe to the court your impression of their mental health without having diagnosed anything on that subject. Is that fair?
Well, do recall that people use these terms kind of interchangeably, and we'll talk about psychological health and well-being and things like that. But if you notice I was asked in the opening statements about what I was being asked to do, I did refer to the emotional toll on the plaintiffs, young people, and future generations of Montanans. And I did specifically tug out the MEPA climate exception and the impact, the emotional toll. I've not referred to the diagnosis here and don't feel that it's necessary.
I did hear you say that. And I guess as a layperson, I believed it was sort of interchangeable with mental health, emotional toll. Not so?
It is used interchangeably, but of course everything has connotations. And people tend to use fancier words when they're going to use diagnostic terms. But I prefer use terms that people ordinary lay people can understand, and they don't have to wade through something that might not be as that they might not as easily respond and understand.
In any of the three situations that you remember about testifying in court, were you there as sort of as an opposing opinion to another doctor or psychiatrist?
No, I don't believe that. I'm recalling. I don't believe there was another forensic expert
on the other side.
That's correct. That's my recollection.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. You can step down.